Thank you so much for coming this evening. Jim set the stage for, you know, trying to understand the nature of the insurgency in Afghanistan and the way in which Canadian, you know, forces under NATO and the United States have been responding. And what I want to do is step back a little bit and tell you a little bit about the experiences that we had in Afghanistan last year, and then talk a little bit about what it makes sense for Canadians to ask for, Canadians of conscience, activists, progressives, to demand of their government, and also tell you a little bit about RAWA, the Revolutionary Association of the Women of Afghanistan, this incredible organization of women that we've been doing solidarity work with, as one possible way in which individuals can try to make a difference to the people of Afghanistan. We went there a year ago in February, actually, of 2005 to research this book and also to do some documentation of the projects that we oversee, because we help fund a lot of humanitarian and political projects for RAWA. And as part of our nonprofit work, we also try to document that the money is being spent properly, et cetera. And we talked to, you know, many, many different people, a broad cross-section of society that included students, human rights lawyers, journalists, refugees, women who were in RAWA's adult literacy classes, orphans, and we really tried to get a sense from them about how they feel about the current Afghan political situation, and how they feel about the United States, because it was very important for us to know what Afghans thought, and really to have that be the basis of the recommendations that we make. It doesn't make sense for us to sit back and apply ideas unless we actually consult with the very people in whose name we're claiming to do solidarity work with. So we went to Afghanistan, and even though, you know, I'm from India originally, and I thought I knew what it was like to be in a very, very poor country in the global south, to be faced up front with indescribable poverty, and, you know, going to Afghanistan shattered any illusions that I might have had, was even more devastating than the kind of poverty that I've seen in India. And we went in at a time when it was still winter, and there was snow on the ground. Afghanistan, you know, many parts of Afghanistan experience a very harsh winter. It's a mountainous country. It's also a breathtakingly beautiful country, littered with the remnants of decades of war. You know, you might drive by a gorgeous landscape with mountains and snow-capped, you know, peaks, and then a shell of a Soviet tank sitting in the middle of it. And, you know, these sorts of things are the testament to the decades of war that Afghanistan has witnessed. There was in Kabul, the capital, which we spent a few days in, so much poverty, even though that is the focus of much of the aid agencies, that's the focus of the media attention. We saw, you know, thousands of refugees have returned to Afghanistan. Before the Taliban fell, Afghanistan was, Afghan refugees were the second largest refugee population in the world, second only to Palestinians. And after the fall of the Taliban, the U.S. and the Bush administration said, you know, Afghanistan is now safe, we want Afghans to return to their country, and they use this return of refugees as a measure of success to show that the country was now safe. Well, the media didn't cover what happened to refugees when they came back to Afghanistan, and what happened was that they had no food, no employment, no health care, no job training, no homes. Many of their homes had been taken over by warlords, and they became refugees in their own country. And Kabul, many large swaths of Kabul have been turned into squatters' camps. And we witnessed much of that. We interviewed a young woman and her who was there with her children, and just really saw the squalor in which they live. You know, whole areas of Kabul are just littered with garbage. There is very little electricity. I mean, there were like a few hours of electricity a day. There was very little, you know, running water. And this is the condition under which, you know, that was 4 years after the so-called liberation of Afghanistan, when you would have expected, at least in the capital, at least for the eyes of the international media, these basic infrastructural needs would have been met. Now, if you compare how much money the international community has spent on, and mostly the US and NATO have spent on military operations, to the amount of money spent on aid and development, you see something like $84 billion on military operations and $7.3 billion on humanitarian work, aid agencies, et cetera. Much of even that money is squandered. You know, it goes towards high salaries for foreign workers and high rents in an area that's now become gentrified rather than actual help. And so this country that we promised never to abandon, this country that the US promised that it would never again forget about, is once more falling apart. Under just poverty and starvation, even not counting the insurgency, not counting the warlordism, just sheer poverty, lack of infrastructure, and refugees. The average lifespan of an Afghan woman is 45 years of age. Literacy rates, between 4 and 10% for Afghan women. Among the highest maternal mortality rates in the world, the highest infant mortality rates in the world. And these were the same statistics before the fall of the Taliban and after the fall of the Taliban. So we have to really ask ourselves, I mean, there isn't even a trend in a positive direction. Except in Kabul, there have been some changes in terms of women's freedom, in terms of them having some access to employment compared to the rest of the country, them appearing more free because they're able to dress more freely. They still can't drive. Or they don't drive. I mean, technically they can, but they don't. On paper, there have been some freedoms won. On paper, the institutionalized oppression of women is no longer there. On paper, they, in the constitution, Afghan women and men are equal. But in practical terms, there's very little. In practical terms, dozens of girls' schools have been burnt down in the last few years. There was a Chicago Tribune article to that effect earlier this year, and hundreds have closed down out of fear. So it's a very dismal situation, it's very grim, and the people that we talked to about the situation, they said that despite all of this horror, despite all of this poverty, they were still hopeful. You know, it's so amazing how hopeful and how patient the Afghan people have been after so much war. But after the fall of the Taliban, they were hopeful that at least the international community was paying attention to them. And we asked them what they thought about the Karzai government. You know, we asked them what they thought about the US support for the Karzai government. They all know he's a US puppet. They all know what the history of US involvement has been in Afghanistan. And we were there a few months after the presidential elections where a majority of Afghans had actually voted for Karzai. And we said, you know, why is it that most Afghans voted for Karzai? And we found out that Afghans were very smart. They basically made a very tactical decision. Just as in the United States in 2004, we had an anybody but Bush campaign, and many progressives, people of conscience, liberals voted for John Kerry. They did so not because they thought Kerry was some progressive savior or some radical anti-war, you know, activist. They did so because he wasn't Bush, because he didn't have the kinds of crimes on his record that Bush had. And the Afghan people voted for Hamid Karzai because he promised to get rid of the warlords. It was an anybody but warlords campaign. And they did it because he did not have the blood of the Afghan people on his hands. Those are the sorts of words that we heard over and over again. And of course, unfortunately, right after that, Hamid Karzai turned around and appointed warlords to his cabinet, and they've become very cynical. And in the parliamentary elections a year later, you had much lower turnout. And so even, you know, whatever sort of democratic development there had been in Afghanistan is slowly eroding. So those were among the things that people talked about. And we asked them, what do you think about the US occupation? And we really wanted them, and we were really hoping that they would say, we are completely against foreign occupation. The US should leave. Because Afghanistan is an historically anti-imperialist nation. They have fought off one foreign army after another, whether it was the Brits, the Russians, the Soviets, they fought them off. They drove them out. But we were very shocked to find Afghan people, most of them saying, we don't like the presence of foreign troops, but we think they're temporarily necessary. And this was a year ago. Things have changed. And we asked them why. And one of them said to us, you have to think about it as though the foreign occupation could be a bitter medicine to take away a sickness that has plagued us for so long. We don't like the bitter medicine, we don't like the sickness either, but we're willing to tolerate a bitter medicine if there's any hope for the sickness to be relieved. And then this person added, it's possible that in the future the bitter medicine may cause the sickness, which is exactly what's happening right now. And there were polls showing Afghan people would have tolerated temporarily a foreign presence in their country if there was hope for security, because they liked the Taliban, they liked the warlords even less than they liked the foreign occupation. That has changed because this summer, the United States, and particularly with NATO's involvement, has expanded their operations, their hunt and kill operations, to such an extent and brutalized so many people and detained and tortured and bombed so many people that more and more people are now realizing that they better throw their lot in with the Taliban. Whichever side is going to protect them from the other, more dangerous side is a side that they will pick, as would any of us, perhaps. And you're seeing an increase in suicide bombings. Afghanistan had never witnessed suicide bombings before. It was a new phenomenon in Afghanistan until last December. And now they're practically every other week. And more Afghans are dying even than foreign troops. It's becoming a more dangerous place, and the presence of foreign troops is making it even worse. So where does NATO fit into all of this? And why is NATO so interested in being in Afghanistan in the first place? I want to actually read just a short segment from our book on NATO, which I think helps to put it into context. In the last chapter in our book, we try to look at why the United States was in Afghanistan and why it's interested and what the NATO role has been. The North Atlantic Treaty Organization, the NATO, bound the U.S. with Western European nations since 1953 in response to the growing Soviet-backed communist movement in Eastern Europe. In the years following the fall of the Soviet Union, the usefulness of NATO was called into question. Quote, warfare by committee as practiced by NATO has simply become too cumbersome in an age that requires light and lethal strikes, explained writer Robert D. Kaplan. The events of 9/11 and US actions that followed provided the perfect opportunity for NATO to reinvent itself and increase its relevance, particularly as a military force at the US's disposal. NATO and the US are seen to have a common agenda. According to Defense Secretary, U.S. Defense Secretary Rumsfeld, quote, NATO nations are those, for the most part, those countries on Earth that have the same values as we do in North America, end of quote. After the 1999 U.S.-led war against the former Yugoslavia, Afghanistan was NATO's first military operation. But more significantly, it was the first time NATO involved itself in Asia. And immediately after September 11, 2001, the North Atlantic Council invoked Article 5 of the North Atlantic Treaty, which is, quote, an armed attack against one or more allies shall be considered an attack against them all. The commitment to assist a NATO ally is not unconditional. Rather, each member country will assist the ally under attack with, quote, such action as it deems necessary, including the use of armed force. And in October 2001, which is also the time when the U.S. began its bombing campaign in Afghanistan, NATO Secretary General Lord Robertson, in a speech entitled, Is NATO Up to the Challenge?, enthusiastically declared his hope that NATO would be part of whatever response the U.S. decided upon. And this is what he said. The Article 5 commitment is alive and well, and it applies to U.S. soil just as it applies to Europe. This should leave no room for doubts or second guessing. We stand together. Europe and North America are one single security space. The events of September 11th have not invalidated NATO's pre-September agenda. If anything, they have reinforced the logic of that agenda. If the U.S. Congress asks the Europeans, "What have you done for me lately?" we should be ready to give a decent answer. It should be noted that the statement was made even before the U.S. began actually bombing Afghanistan and before there was any public mention of the invasion of Iraq. U.S. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld warned, quote, if NATO does not have a force that is quick and agile, which can deploy in days or weeks instead of months or years, then it will not have much to offer the world in the 21st century, by which he meant offer, of course, the U.S., not the world. NATO Secretary General Robertson was ready to deliver, saying, flexibility and usability are the keynotes of NATO's overhaul. NATO's ability to provide a, quote, flexible force for the U.S. is extremely useful in the face of the United Nations' cumbersome machinery of discussion, dialogue, and semi-democratic voting on international military operations. With the NATO response force serving as a, quote, indispensable warfighting instrument at its disposal, the U.S. can bypass the U.N. on peacekeeping and other military operations, as well as allow its own forces to focus on the important task of, quote, war fighting. And of course, since we've written this book, we've now found out that NATO is also very much happy to join the U.S. in the war fighting. So that's just some context to which I think helps explain NATO and, of course, by extension, Canadian involvement in Afghanistan. Basically, NATO wants to be useful in the 21st century because they don't want to be obsolete. They need a reason to continue existing. And the war in Afghanistan has given NATO a chance to do just that, particularly the countries of Canada and the United Kingdom. So what should Canadians do? What should Canadians do with your 2,300 troops, which, by the way, frankly, are insignificant to the 36,000 strong force in Afghanistan? If NATO were to, and Canada were to, if Canada were to withdraw its 2,300 troops tomorrow, yes, the U.S. would lose something a little bit militarily on the ground, given NATO's, given Canada's expertise in war fighting. But overall, there would still be about 3,400 troops left in 34,000 troops left in Afghanistan doing that kind of war fighting. For Afghan people, it wouldn't make that much of a difference. But for the United States, politically, it would be a big slap in the face, a huge slap in the face. It would be a way for Canadians to say, we will not be part of your game. We will not be part of your war fighting. We will not be part of this dichotomy that has been created by Bush in the 21st century that you're either with us or you're against us. We will not be part of this terrorism game, this war on terrorism, this war against a noun that has only increased terrorism. There was just a report I was reading recently. I think it just came out today, showing that 16 US intelligence agencies put out together saying that since the war on Iraq has begun, since 2003, terrorism in the world has increased hugely, and the incidents, the risk of terrorist attacks have increased hugely. This is the world we live in, and Canadians, with its decision about Canadian troops, have the power to make a small difference to the United States. To the United States' agenda in the war on terrorism. And that would be the principled and morally right thing to do if you want to wash the blood off of your hands, if you want to make sure that your conscience remains clear. Now, coming from the United States, Americans can't do that. It's too late. Yeah, we can pull out our troops tomorrow. All that's going to do is prevent Afghans from being killed by US troops in the short term. But it's not going to prevent Afghans from being killed by the instruments that we created, the Mujahideen, the Northern Alliance warlords that Jim was talking about, and the Taliban and the neo-Taliban in the South that are indirectly the results of decades of US policy. It's too late for us to wash the blood off our hands. And so we recommend, particularly for Americans, an even more complex solution that includes supporting an ISAF-like real peacekeeping, defensive, not offensive, troop presence in Afghanistan like we saw in Kabul, because today Kabul is safer than the rest of the country because there were ISAF troops under the UN, not NATO, in the first few years after the fall of the Taliban. And having such a troop presence replace a US-NATO presence accompanied by disarmament, which is what Afghans want, survey after survey has shown, and our own experience with Afghans have shown, accompanied by reparations to help rebuild that country, to make up for the years of damage and the billions of dollars we fueled into destroying that country, and really giving the Afghans a space to breathe, giving the Afghans a space to create real democracy for change. That is absolutely something that we have to ask for, and it doesn't fit neatly on a slogan. It doesn't fit neatly on a poster board at a war anti-war rally. But if we care about the Afghan people, if we care about the collective well-being of all people, it is the kind of responsibility we have to take, because otherwise, we are ridiculed and marginalized since we offer no solutions beyond a troops out now to the powers that be. Again, for Canadians, you still have time to wash the blood off your hands by asking for troops out now. You still have time to strike a political blow against the United States. And if you can't pull the troops out, what then? If you can't succeed in getting Stephen Harper to pull Canadian troops, the small but effective warfighting machine, out of Afghanistan, what can you do? I want to tell you about Rawa, because I think that that is something, in the meantime, in the absence of a troop pullout, in the absence of real constructive change in Afghanistan, some of you can do something about. It sounds self-serving, because I'm asking you to donate money to a charity that I run, but let me tell you about Rawa, because Rawa is the organization that we fund, and why Jim and I volunteer from our day jobs. You know, we've all got day jobs, just like the people who run the Halifax Peace Coalition, why we spend the last 6 years of our lives dedicated to this organization that we're so impressed with. Rawa was founded in 1977 by a young charismatic woman named Mina. She was a young student at the University of Kabul. And she saw that living in a patriarchal conservative Muslim country, which actually was freer then for women than it is today, but nonetheless conservative and patriarchal, as are many countries, to address the situation, she founded the Revolutionary Association of the Women of Afghanistan. And it was only a year and a half later, approximately, that the Soviets invaded Afghanistan, and Rawa realized, and Mina realized, that you cannot fight for women's rights in a situation when your country is fighting for its own sovereignty. And so they joined nonviolently in the mass movement against Soviet occupation and invasion in the decade that followed. But Rawa saw very quickly that US policies of funding and fueling fundamentalist forces in Afghanistan against the Soviets were going to have a very, very long-term terrible effect for women, because the same forces that the US was fueling were the most misogynist forces in the world. The bulk of the CIA funding went to Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, a man who was famous for throwing acid in women's faces if they refused to wear the veil. Of course, he is now one of the most anti-American commanders around and is, you know, number third, I think, on the list of most wanted after Bin Laden and Mullah Omar. But Rawa realized, and Mina realized, that it was very important to fight against these twin evils that they face in their country, foreign imperialism and religious fundamentalism. And they have been fighting since 1977 for a secular, democratic Afghanistan based on human rights and women's rights. They are a non-sectarian organization that do not espouse any one ideology or another except for basic democracy and human rights and non-exploitation. In 1987, Mina was brutally murdered by a collaboration between the forces of Gulbuddin Hekmatyar and the Soviet secret police, because she symbolized, and Rawa symbolized, a threat to both these twin evils. And they tried to destroy Rawa. And what it did instead was it made Rawa flourish. It forced them underground. And today this is an organization of about 2,000 active members, all women, all living in Afghanistan or in the refugee camps of Pakistan, who conduct humanitarian projects as well as political projects. And this unique combination of humanitarian and political work is what makes them so impressive and so worthy of admiration. On the one hand, they run schools. Education is their most central form of long-term societal change. How many of us here in Northern America start with education? If we want to change the world, very few of us feel that we have to start with this very long-term strategy of educating our boys, because if we don't, others will. If we don't, you know, share our values of social justice with our children and incorporate that into their education, then we may lose them. And that's what Rawa does, is they have developed this incredible educational policy that sounds like the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, if you read it. It's based on gender tolerance, ethnic tolerance, it's based on respect for the environment, it's based on equality and democracy and freedom, and a people's history, and incorporates a people's history of Afghanistan and not the history written by the victors and the warlords. And so education is a really important part of their work, and they run many schools around the country. And these are modest schools, let me tell you. We visited them. They're not grand by any means. The only adornment on the walls are framed pictures of Mina, who has now become a martyr for Rawa. Orphanages. They run many orphanages around the country for both boys and girls, for the thousands of orphaned parents whose parents were killed, these orphans whose parents were killed by decades of war or starvation, or who had parents step on a landmine or were killed by the Taliban or by the US bombings. They also run literacy courses for adult women, and they basically train women who don't have any other skills to get some kind of skills, and it ranges from embroidery. We have some embroidery, some crafts that were made in literacy courses that Rawa runs here today. It ranges from embroidery to chicken farming, to fish farms, to goat farming. And all of these basic skills where RAWA provides the material. It's not micro-lending. It's RAWA providing the material and helping them sell the products that they make so that they can sustain themselves. It also includes rehabilitation of prostitutes, a taboo topic in Afghanistan that no other Afghan-led organization will touch. And rehabilitation and incorporation of widows, thousands of women who've been widowed, into society. This is just the humanitarian work, and of course, healthcare, teaching women to be midwives in their communities, teaching women basic health skills. And then on the political front, documentation of human rights abuses. This women's organization who learned years ago that they could use digital cameras under their burqas to document the abuses of Taliban and Northern Alliance members. That, how many of you remember that very, very distinct video of an Afghan woman in a burqa being executed by Taliban in the soccer stadium? It was part of this documentary by Saira Shah called Behind the Veil or something like that. That was done by a RAWA member, Zarmina. And that kind of documentation using digital cameras, where they were basically asking people to send them digital cameras so they could take the photographs because nobody else was paying attention before 9/11. The world had stopped caring about Afghanistan, and RAWA was among the only organizations that were documenting these human rights abuses, publishing them in their quarterly magazine, Payam-e-Zand, the oldest women's magazine, political magazine in the country, as well as on their website, rawa.org, which they founded in 1997, which has been a window for the rest of the world into this incredible, incredibly brave and heroic women's organization. Their political organizing also involves writing statements every few months on political changes in the country, which they publish on their website. So they put out their own recommendations for what they think should happen, and demonstrations, defying the stereotype of mute, faceless Afghan women that we saw in our newspapers after 9/11. RAWA organizes demonstrations of thousands of Afghan women with their faces uncovered, fists in the air, carrying signs saying we want democracy and human rights, we reject these warlords, we denounce the US for doing what it's done, and we want freedom and security. And all those photos are on RAWA's websites. They're there for any of you to see. This unique combination of political and humanitarian work is the hope for Afghanistan. I've not found another organization like RAWA, and for these last 6 years, I've waited to find something about this organization that is maybe, you know, will maybe make me stop and think about whether I really want to support them. And I will still keep that open mind, because sometimes I wonder, you know, how it is that they figure these things out. Well, after Mina was killed, they realized that they had to move underground and that they had to be really careful about their own safety, because they are in danger every single day of their lives and they cannot operate openly. So RAWA members use false names. They move around from place to place. They don't stay in any one location for more than a few months. They cannot be photographed. And the face of Mina has become the face of Afghan women in RAWA today. The face of Mina has become RAWA's face and every single RAWA member's face. And they are now a leaderless organization that has a horizontal, non-hierarchical structure formed of elected committees that have maybe perfected the art of internal organizing that I've come across. I mean, how many of us are in organizations where we face the challenge of how to deal with internal conflicts? And I wrote a paper this summer about what the left can learn from RAWA. Much of this is exemplified in Anne Brodsky's book, With All Our Strength. If you want to learn more about how RAWA operate, it's a book called With All Our Strength. And it was written by a community psychologist from the University of Maryland, Anne Brodsky, who spent several months with RAWA, literally very intimately with them, interviewed hundreds of their members, and did this very detailed book on it. It's the definitive book about RAWA. And we had actually a couple of copies with us, but they got sold in Toronto, and we didn't have any left to bring with us. But I really highly recommend it. So in the absence of the sort of practical, in the absence of the very important moral step that I hope Canadians take, and I hope you show up to your demonstrations on October 28th, in the absence of that, or in the meantime, as you're working towards that, I encourage you to think about supporting a group like RAWA, whether it's financially or through moral support. You can join our monthly donor program. You can write them an email and let them know that you know they're existing and that you are in solidarity with them and that you're going to do everything you can to get their warfighting troops out of their country. Tell somebody about RAWA. Because if there is a group like RAWA in Afghanistan, fighting against religious fundamentalism and for democracy and against Western imperialism, we might have to really explain why Afghanistan needs any sort of foreign intervention whatsoever aside from reparations. They don't need saving. Afghan women in Afghanistan does not need liberation. What they need is to get our governments off their backs so that they can go about the business of rehabilitating their country, reconstructing their country. Thank you very much.